Tuesday, February 16th. We have a full agenda. We're going to get started. We have a series of public hearings and possible work sessions. I'd like to start off with House Concurrent Resolution 205, then we will go to hearing from, we will move on to a public hearing on House Bill 4170. Those are the first couple we'll do. So, and colleagues, we're going to do possible introduction and committee measures at the end. So please stick out the whole time if you can. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 205. And Representative Kenemer, would you like to join us? And Mr. Martin and Mr. Byers? Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Bill Kenemer, State Representative, District 39. Today, I'm here on behalf of House Concurrent Resolution 205, and I thank you for introducing this. Alan Pinn was a very special person. I had the privilege of knowing him for some 30 years. He served here in the legislature years ago. We're going to have a few comments from the other two people about that. He was a mentor, a friend, and a great guy, and I think very appropriate, and I appreciate you introducing this bill.
Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair, my name is Roger Martin, and I'm happy to be here. I'm a lobbyist, as most of you know, and I'm happy to be here on a bill I don't think anybody will disagree with. I had the honor of serving with Alan Pinn 40 years ago in this body. He served for 2 years. He fit the label of citizen legislator. He came. He lost to Ralph Groner, who most of you know, in the following election, but didn't mind at all because by that time he had two twin boys who were infants at home and wanted to spend the time with them. I just want to tell you a couple of things about Alan. He was a very bright person, very complex. He fit the bill of bipartisan because he had friends all over the legislature. He had a marvelous sense of humor that was kind of devastating at times. I don't know if you still have on your desk, but at that time we had little note cards from the desk of. And he became very good friends with Rich Kennedy, a Democrat from Eugene, who Representative Barnard probably knew. And they collaborated in one incident that nobody that was there will ever forget. In the 1971 session, there were several freshman legislators, and in the same aisle sat Norma Paulus, a Republican from Marion County, and Nancy Fadley, a Democrat from Eugene. They sat in the same aisle. They didn't know each other. Pinn and Kennedy had stolen the note cards and started a series of notes. The first one went to Norma Paulus from Nancy Fadley. Of course, it wasn't her. It said, "You sure talk a lot for a freshman." And that escalated over a three-hour period in one of those late May sessions when you're sitting on the floor passing one Ways and Means bill after another. By the end, the last note said, "If you say one more word to me, I'm going to tear your eyes out." At which point, Norma realized, "This is strange," and turned around and saw the two of them in the back double up in laughter and went back and said, "You blankety blanks. Now I have to go back and explain to Nancy, who won't believe it, that those notes weren't for me." The other one story that was classic, the Ways and Means Committee, as you may remember, traveled all over the state to visit various state complexes. And that year, they went to Camp Rialea on the Oregon coast. 1971, the Vietnam War was still on. The military was very unpopular. And the military in Oregon, the National Guard, had old, worn-out Second World War equipment, most of which didn't work very well. And they started a tour of the camp. And a major was leading it. And they'd stop and look at a piece of machinery. And Pinn would look at the Major, would you have the sergeant start that tractor? And he'd get on, wouldn't start. They went through four or five of these. Start that tank, wouldn't start. Nothing worked because it was pretty inoperable. The UPI had a reporter following this round, watching intently what was going on. And at the end, he came up to Pinn and said, "Representative Pinn, tell me what your opinion is of the National Guard." That opinion made the headline in every newspaper in Oregon the next day and went all over the nation. Legislator says the Oregon National Guard is equipped to fight World War I again. And the military, the National Guard was furious. But the interesting follow-up of that is the U.S. government decided to start replacing equipment, and that one comment probably brought in millions of dollars of new military equipment for the National Guard. Penn had that sense of humor. He was a wonderful guy. He had Alzheimer's the last 10 years, one of those sad diseases that I hope all of us hope we can figure out a way to cure. But he truly was a citizen legislator and one that deserves to be honored, and thank you for introducing this bill. And I'd like Wade Byers to talk now, and I want to tell you, Wade is more popular than any of you in this room when it comes to the election. He's been mayor of Gladstone for 33 consecutive years.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs and committee members. It's indeed a privilege to say something on behalf of my longtime friend, Alan Penn. He was a very complex person. He had an incredible amount of interests. He was fascinated in guns and wild animal heads. He would go buy wild animal heads, but he didn't hunt. Just a lot of contradictions. Very bright. Very good family man. His sons are very proud of him. For me, a measure of a person is how they've done in their life and how their families do and how their businesses do, and in all counts, Al was very successful.
Thank you.
And somewhat on behalf of his sons, because they can't be here today, I want to thank the committee and the legislature for taking the step to recognize their father for his service to our state and his district and the people that he cared a lot about.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any comments or questions for our panel? Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank
you. And
thank you all.
Mr. Byers, Mr. Martin, for bringing this forward. And I will close the public hearing on HCR 205 and open a work session on HCR 205.
Madam Chair, I move that House Concurrent Resolution 205 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Olson. Co-Chair Olson moves HCR 205 to the floor with a be adopted motion. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. Representative Kenemer, would you like to be the carrier on the floor? Thank you. Thanks very much. That will close the work session on HCR 205. I apologize. I'm going to move what I said earlier. We're gonna have a brief. I'm gonna open House Bill 4172, so Representative Tomei can testify, and then we'll go to 4170, so Representative Hunt can testify, and we'll come back to both of those. So, with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4172. Cheyenne, do you want to give us a?
Chair Cotem, Chair Olson, members of the committee. House Bill 4172. There's no revenue impact. The fiscal statement did issue, and it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It permits employment of retired state police officers to enforce tobacco laws. It authorizes the Oregon Health Authority to apply for public and private monies for the Department of State Police to use to that end, and it declares an emergency is effective on passage.
Thank you, Cheyenne. And colleagues, this is a committee bill that we got started just the other day. And with that, Representative Tomei, would you like to start us off?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Co-Chair Olson and members of the committee. I'm State Representative Carolyn Tomei. I represent House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. I appreciate you hearing the bill today, and I want to especially thank Representative Olson for all his work in bringing this bill forward today. Recently, it's come to our attention that although our laws prohibit tobacco sales to persons under 18 years of age, that law is not being enforced. Public health officials have no enforcement authority, so although they monitor the times that minors are successful in buying tobacco, there is no penalty assessed and there are no consequences for violating the law. In 2009, 27% of 11th graders who reported obtaining tobacco were able to illegally purchase tobacco from stores. And in 2010, 19% of retailers in Oregon sold tobacco to minors. This is especially disturbing since in order to retain our full federal substance abuse prevention and treatment block grant allotment, Congress requires that each state monitor the rate of tobacco sales to minors and make sure that the rate stays below 20%. Obviously, we're very dangerously close to that limit, and we could face losing the federal money, amounting to a cut of almost $7 million. This bill would direct the Oregon State Police to work with retired officers to enforce our retail tobacco age restrictions. Retired state troopers had been successful with these operations in the past, and this legislation would formalize that relationship again. We've worked with the Oregon Health Authority, the Addictions and Mental Health Department, and Oregon State Police and others to craft this solution. And again, I want to give special thanks to Representative Olson for his work with the state police. And I want to emphasize two important points. This legislation adds no new regulation on the sale or the use of tobacco products. It only serves to enforce the law that we already have. And I urge you to quickly move House Bill 4172 out of this committee and on its way. And I'm open to any questions.
Thank
and
you,
we have other people who here, at least one other person will be testifying.
Yes, we have several folks who want to testify on the bill, but colleagues, questions for Representative Tomei. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. So in your testimony, you specifically said there was no enforcement.
That's right.
As far as citations written to
nothing.
To retailers?
No.
So nowhere out there?
Almost for almost 3 years, Representative.
Yep. And then another question?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Is it your intent for these retired officers to only enforce the underage portion of tobacco sales or all the laws on the books about tobacco?
I think the way the law reads, or this bill reads, it would just be the sales to underage buyers of tobacco. Is that your understanding, Representative?
It actually reads the other way.
Madam Chair, if I can kind of explain that a little bit on that. There's a portion in there that identifies specifically Representative Freeman that talks specifically about the federal law, PL 103 or 102, that deals specifically with that. But then also you'll have some testimony, too, from Oregon Health Authority, too, their perspective on this, too.
Sorry, I heard you say it's your intent of the bill to only enforce the underage selling of tobaccos, not the entire set of Oregon laws that deal with tobacco.
Well, I think I would stand corrected by Representative Olson. Sorry.
Maybe we'll clear this up, but that's a huge difference. There's a whole bunch of tobacco laws.
I understand that.
And underage selling is just one of them.
I know that. Correct. And I understand that. My main intention, I work a lot with children, as you well know, and families. My main intention is not to sell cigarettes to children. But if the law must go further than that, I would support it.
Thank you, Representative. We can clarify that with the next group that will come up after that. But the money specifically, I believe, is only the money that the federal government watches, particularly for underage.
That's right.
Correct. Okay.
For this grant.
I just want to see what the scope is. Thank you.
Nope. Understand. We'll get back to that. Other questions for the representative before we move on? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, committee.
With that, we're going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 4172. And for those in the audience, what we'll do is we'll come back to that. We want to make sure representatives, because they might have other schedules, come up. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4170 related to dog training. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. The continuing members of this committee well remember we came right up to the precipice of passing a very similar bill to this in the 2011 session. Actually got up into the work session, but then weren't quite able to carry it across. So I encourage your favorable consideration of this bill so we can carry it across and get this done. It looks like a much longer bill than it is. I mean, if you really look for the bold type, you'll see it is very narrowly targeted at addressing a challenge with the interpretation, local government's interpretation of land use laws, especially as it relates to activities around dog training and dog activities. We've got, you know, this. I think I saw numbers that show that 40% of Oregon households have dogs, and I know that percentage is higher in Clackamas County. It's a significant issue to make sure that we've got access for a lot of the kennel clubs, a lot of the members of those American kennel clubs across the state, to be able to make sure that they have access to be able to train dogs, whether it's in agility or obedience or herding or all the activities that that they're focused on. This, in a very narrowly targeted way, will enable these dog owners and these dog trainers to be able to go forth in a way that's not going to negatively get into other issues as we've had in previous sessions around trying to protect animals. This, I think, is very narrowly crafted in a way that will remove what is some ambiguity right now in the way that the state statutes are being enforced at the local level. So I would encourage your expeditious and enthusiastic approval of House Bill 4170.
And thank you, Representative, and thank you for sticking with this. Colleagues, any questions for Representative Hunt? We did have this bill in the Rules Committee last year. Representative Holt.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing this back, Representative Hunt, and certainly I hope that we can get something done on this issue because it does need to happen. But at that precipice that you talked about, there was an outstanding issue that I particularly had with this bill, and that was declaring, using Section 215.203 as declaring raising dogs as a farm use. I fully support having dog activities as a use on farmlands, but not specifically as a farm use. So I'm hoping that we can, maybe I can be swayed the other way on that, but I've asked for an amendment on that particular issue. But I still think we can get there and allow these activities on farmlands.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, I think it is narrowly crafted in a way that is not going to, I understand, I mean, I think you've got some very legitimate concerns, and you've had some past legislation that has corrected what was a real problem, I think, with some of the puppy mills that were out there. This, I think it doesn't get into removing any of those precautions we put in before, and I don't think it gets into what some might argue is a slippery slope in our land use system. I mean, if you look at the long laundry list already in statute of in Section 2 there of the following uses that may be established in any area zoned for exclusive farm use, I mean, it's really amazing how many provisions there are already built in, and this just adds letter Z and then has to start the alphabet again because there are already 25 other provisions in there. So I think it's narrowly, I think the language is very narrowly crafted enough that won't have
I don't have a problem with that section of the bill at all. So, anyway.
Thank you all. Always nice to be back with the Rules Committee.
Are there questions, comments for the representative? Thank you. Thank you for being here. Looking at the number of folks who are here to testify on House Bill 4170, we're going to keep the public hearing open on House Bill 4170 and then come back to the tobacco issue in 4172. So I'd like to call up to continue the public hearing on this bill, Charlotte Lehan, Chair of Clackamas County Board of Commission, and Patty Strand. And we didn't do a summary of the bill for everyone in the audience, so why don't we go ahead and do that.
Chair Kotek, Chair Olson, members of the committee, House Bill 4170 permits training of up to 10 dogs and testing of up to 60 dogs up to four times per year as an outright permitted use of land zoned exclusively for farm use. It distinguishes raising and boarding dogs from training and testing dogs and prohibits commercial boarding under the provisions that permit training and testing.
Thank you, Cheyenne.
Okay. Chair Kotek and Co-Chair Olson. My name is Charlotte Lehan. I am chair of the Clackamas County Commission, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 4170. I want to thank Representative Olson in particular for all the work that he's done on this over the last couple of sessions, and Representative Kotek for her help as well. This is I have worked on it for the last two sessions, and just in terms of a little background of myself, I was mayor of Wilsonville for 12 years and city councilor before that. I have a long history and reputation of protecting farmland for agricultural uses. I am a member of Thousand Friends, and I used to work for Thousand Friends, and I feel strongly about protection of farmland for farm uses, and I understand the concerns about expanding allowed uses on farmland. But this is a case where I think previous interpretations, particularly around the Greyhound issues, have unintentionally created an interpretation that dog training was not allowed on farmland. I think dogs always have been farm animals, and dog training and field trials are an integral part of having dogs, especially in rural areas. We tried as a commission to address this issue in the last year at the local level by changing our code to allow it as a conditional use as a home business occupancy, but it ended up being very difficult to do and very expensive for the people who wanted to have a class with 8 or 10 dogs, and because we ran into requiring as a part of a home business occupancy things that we really didn't want to require in agricultural zones, like ADA access and building improvements, paving of parking areas. These weren't things we wanted to require, but it's kind of what the code was requiring us to do if we went that route, rather than having it be an allowed agricultural use where it's only allowed in pre-existing farm buildings or in the outdoors. So that's why we're back here again. The other route didn't work for us, and I think this clarifies the use of dogs in farmland, and I'm entirely comfortable with it. And would hope that you can support it.
Thank you, Chair Lehan. We'll hear from Patty and then take questions. Okay.
Thank you, co-chairs Kotek and Olson and Representative Olson and the whole committee for hearing this bill. It's very, very important to us. And as you heard earlier, it came right up to the precipice at the end of last session and then ended. Been very fortunate to have been able to work with Representative Olson in the off session to try to pull this back together. I'm here representing and speaking on behalf of the Oregon dog community. It's a pretty big group of people, actually. It's about the organized dog community in our state. It's about 7,000 people. These are people that belong to kennel clubs and participate in different kinds of events or do guide dogs or therapy work, that sort of thing. And I'm here to speak on their behalf and to urge passage of this bill because it will enable people to legally participate in events that, frankly, have gone on in Oregon throughout our entire history, but which, as other speakers have alluded to, because of sort of the evolutionary nature of the land use laws over the last number of years, some of the interpretations by counties have been, the law itself is sort of muddled. There are conflicting laws out there. And so counties have felt constrained from approving events that are not specifically mentioned in the statute. So despite the fact that we have about 550,000 Oregon households, both rural and urban, that keep dogs, and despite the fact that that dogs have always played a huge role in Oregon's rural lifestyles, the status of dogs on the EFU really does need to be clarified, because as the result of the haziness that's going on today, as Chair Lehan has spoken to, is that people have literally lost their livelihoods, and we need to fix that. It's a serious problem. Again, when 40% of households have a dog, it is a lifestyle interest that is impacting. So that's why we've worked so hard to draft a bill that would correct the situation. And again, as others have alluded to already, there was great support for our bill when we brought it forth last session, and I think everybody supported our goals, but we frankly just didn't know how to get it there legislatively. We were new to this process, and so during the off session, working with the leadership of Representative Olson, and then later as Representative Kotek became a co-chair of the committee as well. With her, we have worked to create a bill that will achieve our goals while recognizing some of the concerns that the other parties have. We've worked with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, with Chair Lehan of Clackamas County, with Sean Cleave of the Farm Bureau, and a number of other interested parties. And the result is about 100 hours of work and contributions from pretty much everybody that we've worked with. We've really tried to come up with something that that everybody could feel was good in the end and that honored the whole mission of the EFU. So the difference between the bill that we're offering this session and last is that we have narrowed the focus quite a bit on it, and we have taken the dog training events and the dog activity events out of the 215.203, which is the area that offers a right of use, basically, for all of the things that you want to do with a particular species there. The statute is pretty complicated, and to distill it into my language so it's maybe simple enough to understand, and there are a lot of people probably sitting in this room that could describe this better than me. There are three basic sections, one that offers a basic right of use statewide, and then there are marginal lands, counties, and then there are the rest of the counties in the state. And then within those three areas, there are activities that can be permitted, and there are activities that require a conditional use permit. So what we've done is we've said for the small events, the ones that have the training classes that have 10 dogs or less, and for the events such as an agility testing trial that has 60 dogs or less and 4 events or less a year, that those can go into a permitted section in both the marginal counties and in the rest of the counties. And then we have said that we have actually fixed a little problem that was alluded to, I think, also by Chair Lehan, which is we have, instead of, in the old days, it said kennels in the conditional use section, and we have defined that because we found that there was no definition for kennels. Certain activities regarding kennels were prohibited, but kennels weren't defined. And so we have said what it is that we're really after here, and that is commercial dog boarding kennels will now be in the conditional use section. And those events that are too big, or there are going to be too many of them, to be put in the simple permitted section, we've put them we've left them in a conditional use area. So it's much more streamlined. I think it accomplishes our goals very well. And we are just asking, we're hoping that you'll be able to push this forward because time is really short. Again, we appreciate very much the time that you have given us, but we recognize that this session is very short. So basically, on behalf of the 103 kennel clubs in Oregon and the various people who are part of our community, we thank you for giving it a hearing, and we ask you to please move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Patty, and I would like to say thank you for all the hard work you put into this. I think you're trying to find the solution that works for your folks. We have quite a few people who are here today that aren't going to speak, but they're here in support. Those folks who are in support of the bill, if you want to raise your hand so we know who you are, thank you. Welcome today. Welcome to your capital. And I appreciate that all of you aren't signed up because we'll try to get as many people, but we have a few more folks who have to go. Questions for Chair Lehan or Patty? And they're not going anywhere, so they can come back up. Did I hear?
Yeah.
See a hand down here? No? No? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to call up Steve McCoy, Sean Cleave, and Debbie Berkeley, please. And then the next group I would like, after that, in case so you can be ready, is Bill Hoyt and Jim Welsh. And then we'll hear from Michael Morrissey from DLCD. So.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. I am Steve McCoy. I represent 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I want to say right off the bat that I am a dog lover. I have 2 Vizslas at home that are very much part of our family. However, I would like to suggest a refinement to this bill that we hope would make it better. Our concern with the bill is conflicts in the farm zone. This allows additional uses on EFU, and some of those uses are in subsection 1 of ORS 215.213 and ORS 215.283. The reason that that's important is because things that are in subsection 1 are allowed of right. So you do not need to go to the county to get a permit for those. And there's not a review at the county level for conflicts in the farm zone with those particular things. When things are a sub 2 use, which some of the things in this bill are, then you go for a conditional use permit and the county gets to take a look at things. So our specific concern is in the changes to ORS 215-213-1ZA and 215-283-1XA, so both of those in sub 1 uses, that it allows unlimited 10 dog training classes. So there could be, I think in the testimony I said, 5 concurrent every day of the week, many hours during the day, which would obviously bring conflicts to the farm zone. It would bring traffic and noise. So in a nutshell, that's our concern. What we'd like to see would be place a reasonable limit on the number of dog training classes that could take place per day. And then after that, folks could go get a permit from the county. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Sure.
And colleagues, that's outlined in his written testimony as well. Sean or Debbie, whoever wants to go next.
Co-chairs Olson and Kotek, members of the committee. My name is Debbie Berkeley. I'm from Beaver Creek, Oregon, Clackamas County. I represent the personal side of this story. First, I want to thank you for hearing this bill. It's important to me and many others to have your support of this bill. Passage will allow me to keep my farm, my home, and keep my business here in Oregon. I'm here today representing the sport of dog agility. I'm one of numerous instructors here in Oregon. I'm also a victim of land use interpretation that has resulted in the closure of my business, and it threatens me losing my own home. My husband and I have lived in Oregon all our lives. We currently reside on 9.82 acres in Beaver Creek. It's zoned EFU. We moved there in 1994 to pursue a family horse training business. When the kids grew up and decided horses were no longer a part of our activities, we decided to look for something different to do on our farm. And that's when we found dog agility. Well, our property is ideal for the sport. We have large grassy pastures, plus we have a covered horse arena. It wasn't long before I had classes going, and I needed to look into business permits and licensing. So I hiked myself down to Clackamas County to inquire about what was going to be necessary, and the clerk that helped me, a very nice individual, said that there was nothing about dog agility in the ordinances that he could find that it would allow it as a permitted use. But he also suggested that there was nothing there that specifically prohibited it either, and he suggested that I just simply operate. So I did. I set up a business. In the 13 years that I've been teaching, I've been paying all the appropriate taxes. I keep responsible business records. In October of 2009, I received a letter from Clackamas County stating that I was not allowed to do dog agility on EFU-zoned property. And when I went to inquire, I was told that it originated from an anonymous complaint. This was not a nuisance complaint from my neighbors. It was not a code violation. It was just simply someone went down to the county and reported that that's what I was doing, and they had to act on it. So what I did is my husband and I put our house on the market. I started looking for ways to relocate. What I was looking to relocate to was a small farm with a home, grass pastures, and a covered horse arena, which is exactly what I have. Our house didn't sell. In the meantime, I'm trying to make ends meet, so I was traveling to 3 different barns in 3 different counties in Oregon. And I'm really not comfortable with that. It jeopardizes other people. We don't have statewide help. We don't have laws in place that really allow anyone to do this correctly. We're doing everything possible to get relief. It just hasn't happened. We're getting stretched. I continue to meet with the county. We've explored so many different options. There just really is no solution at the county level, not under the current laws. My training business is not a multi-million dollar business. It's a small home occupation. I don't want to change the characteristics of my farm. In fact, it is a farm. We have sheep. I found a way to use what I already have to make a small sustainable income. It doesn't have any impact on the land at all in a negative way. Dog owners are in desperate need to find properties such as mine to continue their training. It can't be done in urban areas. Agility is growing rapidly. Just because of its growth, it's creating more and more demand all the time, looking for places to train and practice. Finding a way to meet a demand for a product is a solid business principle. Demand for agility training areas is there. Oregon has an opportunity to step up and do something to embrace it. It will bring revenue to this state. It will provide the communities with well-trained canine companions. Again, I ask you to support this bill. And I do have a question for you. Now that we're in a short session and I'm trying to understand this well, I'd like to understand where this process goes from here. What is the next step in all of this? I understand we are in a very short session. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Berkley. And I'll answer that question, then we'll move on to Mr. Cleave. Is that we hope to have this hearing today and hear from everyone. And if we have to craft one more amendment to get this right, we'll want to do that. And then depending on the support of the committee, move it out of the committee, go to the, and then get it to the House floor and then get it over to the Senate. So we are on a quick timeline, but we're hoping we'll get all the information we need today to see if we can move it and make any final changes if we need it. So
thank you.
Yes, and thank you for being here. Sean.
Chair Kotek, Chair Olson, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau, who is strongly neutral in this bill. I think that Ms. Berkley's testimony today does a good job of illustrating some of the frustrations that many Oregonians see with Oregon's land use planning system, especially in the EFU. Oftentimes, I've seen where members of the Farm Bureau even have been instructed through a informal advice of the county planner or county decision maker to, let's just say it's better to ask forgiveness than permission on some land use decisions. That being said, I did work with some of the proponents of the bill over the interim. My original concerns over the legislation that was drafted last session was that the draft never seemed to encapsulate the intent and provide the right parameters around some of the conflicts that could occur in the EFU. I do respect Thousand Friends position regarding mitigating those conflicts through the sub 2 use. I will say as an aside, the Farm Bureau worked very hard with the County Commission or the Associated Oregon Counties last session to craft a bill that wasn't specific to dog uses but did give general parameters for doing various activities so that you wouldn't have to ask for forgiveness in these situations. That bill is still in its infancy regarding implementation on the county level, and I do understand that proponents want more certainty regarding these issues. So I think rather than talk myself into a hole, what I'd like to do is just let you ask any questions of me, and I'll be happy to answer. Thanks.
Thank you, Sean. Questions for our folks here. Representative Berger, and then Representative Freeman.
Mrs. Berkley, or Ms., I don't know, how many dogs do you train how many go into your barn at a time to be for agility training in a typical session?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Berger, let me clarify, are you asking how many people per day would be reasonable?
Like on a typical day, how many would you, when you were in full operation, how many dogs would come in and be running around in your barn being trained? And I love agility training, by the way. I go to the fair and I just get wrapped up in their dog.
Well, personally, I limit my classes to 8. So that would be 8 dogs at one time.
Okay. And then second follow-up, do they come in every day?
No, not every day. I would like to do 3 to 4 days a week. That's all I can physically handle. Now, that would be one class, 8 dogs. I could probably handle 2, maybe even 3 classes a day. For one person, that's a lot of physical work.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just trying to visualize what it looks like in your barn, how many dogs are running around and how frequently.
Each dog would be paired with one person, so okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Just getting a vision of that.
Sure. Thank you. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and I'll be brief. This is more of a statement than a question, but I find it pretty amazing that we're worried about noise and conflict in a farm area. I'm not so sure the stuff that's growing is going to care all that much. I thought that was an interesting statement. But more importantly, and I said this last time we heard this bill, this is your land. You should be able to do with it what you want. This is a property rights issue, and I cannot believe we can't get this figured out. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Winger.
Well, you kind of stole my thunder, but I haven't been here that long, just 3 years, and nothing frustrates me more and makes and saddens me more than the state of affairs around this issue, that any Oregonian who simply wants to run a dog agility business has to come down to their state capital and ask permission from the state government to run that business is so symbolic of what is wrong in this state. We seriously, seriously need to ask ourselves questions of how we have gotten to that state where somebody has to come down here and beg their state government to let them run a dog agility business on their farmland.
Thank you, Representative.
And for what it's worth, and it's worth very little, Deborah, I apologize to you that it has come to this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Mm-hmm. We are trying to balance all kinds of uses on this land, and while this is a complicated process, I think you're advocating well to get what you need, so hopefully we can resolve this. Representative Barnard?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to simply say I very much appreciate what you're doing in terms of getting this issue resolved and the effort that you've had to go through to do it. I'm hoping that we can deal with the technicalities that we're facing and that we can move this bill along. I do understand there's a technicality that I don't fully understand, but I hope to soon, and that we'll be able to do that.
Thank you, Representative. I actually have a question for Ms. Berkley. Given the testimony from Mr. McCoy, mm-hmm. Would it make more sense to have a per class, per day restriction if we were trying to limit or number of days during the week? I don't want to overwrite that section, but I get the comment about, given what you're saying, you know, you probably wouldn't do more than 3 classes a day. Would you rather have number of classes per day as a frequency issue, or would it be number of days a week if we were going to address that issue?
Let me pose one more thought to consider. The training school that I operate is pretty high caliber for this state. We like to bring in presenters who also would like to present on the weekend so they conduct state-of-the-art training and ideas and whatnot. So even though it wouldn't be a regular occurrence, a Saturday and Sunday, like 9 to 5, would be something, you know, 2 or 3 times a year we'd love to have. Mm-hmm. For a regular work schedule, a limit of classes per day is probably quite reasonable. I don't want to conduct, personally, I couldn't handle 5 classes a day, but if I had 5 classes as a limit, it would be more than adequate, more than sufficient. Okay. Is that?
Yes, answer? That's helpful.
Okay.
Again, trying to get a picture of what actually is
5 classes
makes functional
would,
sense.
Sure, 5 classes would represent 40 people, 40 individualized attention. That would just have me toast in no time.
I was going to say, that would be a lot. That would be a lot. Thank you for responding to that. Other questions for the panel? Seeing none, thank you. Thanks very much for being here. If we could have Mr. Bill Hoyt and Jim Welsh join us, and then I'd like to call up, actually, Mr. Morrissey, why don't you come up as well? We can fit all 3 of you at the table. Michael Morrissey from DLCD. And that is who I have on my list who would like to testify. Is there anyone who is not on that list that needs to testify? Okay, not seeing anyone. Mr. Welsh, Mr. Hoyt, whoever wants to go first. Just identify yourself for the record. Thank you for joining us.
Co-Chair Kotek and Co-Chair Olson, Jim Welsh from the representing Oregon Cattlemen Association. We have given support for this concept now, I think, roughly three sessions. And, you know, we definitely support this use. And the question that comes to our mind is, where else would you approve of these of this kind of activity in a farm use area, a designated area like that? We wouldn't move it closer to the urban area or anything else. And so, you know, we also use, my clients use an awful lot of dogs in working with their cattle and their sheep and everything else. And so training, it really needs to occur. And we certainly don't have any problem with the events that will be established on these properties also. So we come in very strongly in supporting this bill, and it's good to know that there's some concessions, but we feel it should be an outright use on as a designation on exclusive farmland. So that's where we have stood on this, and we are continuing to do that, and we hope that you will pass this out of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Co-Chair Olson, I'm Bill Hoyt. I am the legislative chair of the Oregon Cattlemen Association. I'm also a sheep grower. Don't tell anybody.
Your secret's safe.
I'm here to speak in support of this bill. And the main reason is this isn't something that it's unrelated directly to my living, but being able to use the tools in the box, and I appreciate the comments earlier about whether or not we had to ask permission to do this. I raise and train border collie dogs for use in the livestock industry, and they are part of the tools that we use. They are an integral part. My best dog is with me today. Without training, however, and without the ability to assess her progress in that training, we really take a tool away from that. So I have one of my close friends is the publisher of the Working Border Collie magazine and lives in Ohio. And he travels all over the world putting on clinics for those people like myself who have border collies who need some technique training for how we could become better at handling our dogs, at reading our livestock, at being able to in a quality way do the things required to manage and work our livestock, both cattle and sheep. And so without those clinics, I can hire him to come to Oregon, and he, his stature in the industry would attract, you know, 8 or 10 owners who would come in and participate in a clinic. This doesn't happen all the time, but if it did, I've had several clinics over the years at the ranch where neighbors and people have come in and participated. It's absolutely the state-of-the-art training methods that these people bring are something that a lot of us that don't get off the ranch very much really need to have. So the ability to do that, I think the lady that testified on agility goes to that point. I wouldn't do this on a regular basis, nor would I do it for a living. I would do it as a service to my neighbors or friend and to myself to be able to be in a place where I could make better use of my dogs. The other side of that is the guard dog situation. We have guard dogs that guard the sheep against predators. And what most people, it's an instinctive thing, but there is a lot of training that goes on that where we have to deal with those guard dogs and say, all right, how do we best, you know, teach them fence lines? How do we best? I have a couple of male dogs don't know where my ranch stops and the neighbor starts. If a coyote leaves the ranch, they're on it. And so, you know, you have to be able to train them to say, hey,
here's where the property line stops, and if you get off the property line, you know, you don't do either one of us any good. So those are things that I think that we need to address in this bill, and hopefully this bill will be something that we can all benefit from. So I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you for being here. Mr. Morris?
Madam Chair and Co-Chair Olson and committee members, I'm Michael Morrissey. I'm a policy analyst with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Technically, we're neutral on this bill. We did come in last session with some concerns that we have worked during the interim with Ms. Strand and some of the other departments and organizations, and we're much more comfortable with this bill than we were at that time. At this point, our only concern has to do with Section 4, which allows these activities on high-value farmland. Part of the way we looked at this bill and tried to be efficient about how the bill came forward to you was that there are, both in statute and in commission rule, provisions for kennels. And the commission, back before I worked for the department, probably in the 90s, adopted rules that disallowed kennels on high-value farmland. And now we're merging both kennels and dog training and dog training and other activities. We considered the possibility of going along with, if you will, that these provisions would now allow these activities on high-value farmland and, in essence, override the commission's current rule on kennels. When the bill was written up in LC form for the first time, the way that the Legislative Council chose to allow these activities on high value was to go into a statute that has a lot of history behind it, and it's referenced in Section 4. And that statute was the subject of some very important court decisions that reflect on the Commission's ability to regulate high-value farmland, et cetera. And at this point, we're not real comfortable with going into that provision to be able to do that. And I'm not really clear on what the outcomes might be of doing it in this way. And so our preference would be not to include the high-value farmland provisions. The commission can always accept a request to go back and change their rule and allow it. And if this was taken out, there would still be allowed these activities as a sub 1 and sub 2 use. And if you choose to do so, also allow it as a part of the farm use definition. But we worked very hard during the interim to kind of get to a good place, and we're almost there except for this one aspect of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morrissey. Questions for the panel?
Co-Chair Olson and then Representative Freeman.
Okay. Michael, I'm just kind of curious. You know, we had some conversation earlier. The high-value farmland, what's the percentage of the farmland here in the valley that's high-value farmland?
Well, I co-chairs and Representative Olson, it's safe to say that a good part of the valley is high-value soils. When it comes to an individual's property, it works on predominance. So someone who had a piece of property, if they really wanted to know whether it was predominantly high value or not, they could go through a process to get that tested. If it's 49% high value and 51% non-high value, the entire property is treated as non-high value. So it's a bit of a case-by-case situation, but it's fair to say that a good part of the Willamette Valley is class 1 through 4 soils and high value.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Okay, so we're talking Clackamas County right now. For example, that would be the same application there as what you just described.
I'm not really in a position to say Clackamas County is any different. I will say that as you get into more sloped areas, it's less likely to be high value. And Clackamas County has a lot of rural residential lands. Now we're talking farmland, of course, but I can't say that it's significantly different than any other part of the valley. That's absolutely true.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, and I appreciate everybody's testimony, and I'll direct this at you, and please don't take it the wrong way. You happen to maybe be the messenger today. You might have heard the testimony earlier from the property owner, and now we've heard from the cattle folks and the sheep folks and the farmers that they're all okay with this. How do you feel when you hear a property owner so upset about not being able to use their land and then coming up as a state agency and suggesting that the bill's not quite right yet? I'm just kind of curious.
So, Representative and co-chairs, I'll say two things. One is I'm part of my job, if you will, and part of the department's job and part of the responsibilities that the legislature gave the commission and the department is to look at the broader picture of protecting farm and forest lands, commercial farm and forest lands. Secondly, I will say I personally put in a lot of time during the interim to try to resolve some of these issues and was very comfortable with a lot of them. And part of what I'm here reflecting to you is somewhat of a technical issue. I have to represent the department and the commission has on the books that kennels are not allowed on high-value farmland. I wasn't part of that process. I don't know who testified, what the arguments were. And I'm additionally saying that the way that LC chose to essentially override the commission's rule is something that I find a little troublesome on a technical basis. So on the whole, I understand what people are saying and kind of support that. And yes, things play out differently for issues, whether it's aggregate or using dogs or anything else. And I'm sorry that in some cases, some people are on the wrong end of that calculation. But in this case, I'm trying to represent as best I can the commission and the department and some of the other issues that I've reflected to you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Holby.
Thank you. I appreciate that description, but it comes back to the question I think that both Representative Olson and Rep. Freeman have talked about is that, you know, whether in the Willamette Valley, almost everything's high-value farmland.
Right.
And so it does seem kind of absurd that we would not allow people to have dog activities on high-value farmland. And so I think Legislative Council has put this in because they want to say that this is okay. And without that, how do we, is it just essentially a rule that LCDC could look at and say, raising dogs and having dog kennels and training classes are okay on high-value farmland? Because certainly I wouldn't think that it permanently destroys the land.
Co-chairs and co-vice chair Holby, I understand what you're saying. As you may be aware, there are other activities that are not allowed on high-value farmland, and one of those, for example, is golf courses. And there are many places in the Willamette Valley that might be great for golf courses, but they're on high-value farmland. And again, I found out through the hard way, in many of these cases when they were discussed maybe 15 or 20 years ago, there are a lot of very passionate issues on both sides of those cases, and I can't reflect that with regard to kennels. So on its face, it seems like there may not be a whole lot of damage to high-value farmland by dogs trotting on the soil, but I'm kind of here to reflect again where the department is. If the commission were approached to do rulemaking and take back that rule, I can't promise that they would take that up, nor what the outcome would be, but that is another option. I also don't know if Legislative Council has a different way to allow these activities on high-value farmland than the way they've proceeded now.
Just a quick follow-up, and I think what, perhaps this committee, I can't speak for the committee, but certainly for myself, I'm looking for some sort of assurance that we'll be able to have dog activities in the Willamette Valley on farmlands. And if that means that we have to put into statute that notwithstanding this, and you can have these dog activities on high-value farmlands, if that's the only way we can have that assurance, then I guess I'm not sure I'm going to support taking Section 4 out. So that's all I'm, that's the little piece that I was kind of curious about.
Thank you.
The other piece that maybe I can, with the chair's indulgence, talk to some folks after this, is I do have some concern in declaring raising and breeding dogs a farm use. I'm very supportive of allowing them, having them allowed uses on farm lands, but I know it sounds really in the weeds, but there's some differences that makes throughout some other chapters of statutes throughout Oregon, and they've basically taken an old statute that referred to kennels for raising greyhounds and the many people I've talked to have felt that was put in the wrong section, that it should have been an allowed use in 213 and 283 parts of the statutes, and not in 203, which has some different ramifications. So I'd like to, you know, maybe sit down with a couple of you certified smart people on farmland use and see if we can figure that piece out, because that one's the biggest trouble that I have in the bill, actually. So I don't know if you have any perspective on Section 203 in the bill and just allowing, declaring raising and breeding dogs a farm use, because I can do that in the city, too. I have two dogs, and if they have babies, I'm technically raising and breeding dogs. So now do I have a farm use inside an urban growth boundary? And does that mean I get a special assessment tax rate for that as well?
Madam Chair.
You could also take this offline if you like. and Jim Johnson from Department of Ag is also here, I'm just saying. Unless you have a brief answer, but if it's a longer conversation, I think it might. I'm appreciative that Representative Holvey has put it out there as a public conversation, but in the interest of time, Representative Holvey, would you like a direct answer now, or should?
It's purely up to.
I just don't know how complicated the answer is.
I'll keep it very short, Madam Chair. But it was one of the concerns that we had when we came in last time. I would say that the department has moved over to a more neutral position at this point. So we're not fighting it. We're not supporting it. But I can talk to you later.
Thank you for raising that topic, Representative. Representative Winger?
So the longer this goes on, the more parts of my soul start to die.
Representative, do you have a question?
He has a soul?
It's really more of a statement. You know, the quickest way for a government or an agency to lose all credibility with the people is to lose sight of the fact that we do this for the people. We're not here for the state of Oregon. We're here for the people of Oregon. And, boy, at some point, you know, we have to factor that in. And I think an average Oregonian listening to this hearing would just be pulling their hair out as to why we even have to have a hearing for somebody to be able to run a dog business in Oregon. So I'm really hoping that we can work out the details of this as quickly as possible and get it off our plate.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much for testifying, and really appreciate you coming. And
Madam Chair, I believe I had the hand
up. Oh, I apologize, Representative. You did. Gentlemen, do you mind? Thank you, Representative. I appreciate the reminder. Representative Esquivel.
He was hiding.
I think this comes back to the inherent problem we have in this state. Senate Bill 100 was a fine piece of legislation, but we, the legislators, abdicated our role in this. We turned it over to people that, are not elected, and two, make up all the rules for the state of Oregon, and we don't really check those rules out. We need to have some legislative oversight on your department, as well as every other department in this state, because these administrative rules take away from the original intent of the bill or the law. And so I'm going to strive to make sure that we get it on the ballot, so we have to change the Constitution, so each and every one of us can have some sort of a way to complain without having to come and ask permission from people that, one, aren't elected, and two, that have no accountability. So I shall proceed on that light, and I think that's the big inherent problem in the state.
Thank you, Representative. Again, thank you for being here. Appreciate your testimony and answers today. And that is... That concludes the folks I have listed who wanted to testify in House Bill 4170. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4170 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 4172. And I have four individuals signed up to testify on 4172. If we could start off with... We have Leah Kraft. Is Leah still here?
Did I say something wrong? Perfect left.
And Colleen Herman Frazen, please. And then after that, we'll have Daryl Fuller and Richard Kosison. Colleagues, this is the tobacco enforcement bill that we started off with Representative Tomei.
case you're tracking.
All right. Good afternoon, co-chairs, Kotek and Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Colleen Herman-Franzen, and I'm here today representing the American Lung Association. The Lung Association is also a member of the Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon. The Lung Association is here today in support of House Bill 4172 because it will reinstate enforcement of Oregon's tobacco access laws and curtail our children's access to tobacco products. We applaud Representatives Olson and Tomei for their leadership on this issue to bring the enforcement of these laws back to Oregon. As Representative Tomei mentioned, the problem is that since 2009, there has been no coordinated enforcement of laws governing tobacco sales to minors in Oregon by any agency. The visual inspections currently taking place to collect survey data are not the same as enforcement operations. During this time period, no citations or fines have been issued to retailers that are breaking the law. At the same time, we're seeing youth tobacco use rates in Oregon steadily increase. Currently, almost 10% of 13 and 14-year-olds say that they smoke, and the national rate for this age group has actually decreased. So we would like to see the state of Oregon follow that national trend. In addition, a lack of enforcement also puts our state at risk for losing federal funds, which are tied to our noncompliance rate. The federal government has the ability to penalize states through cuts to federal grants when the number of illegal purchases by minors becomes too high. It can be no greater than 20% each year. As of 2010, we are at 19% noncompliance rate. That means that if we see an increase of just 1%, we're in danger of losing up to $7 million in federal grant dollars to our state. House Bill 4172 is the solution. This bill will reinstate an effective program formerly run by retired state police officers, and it will also send a strong message to those retailers who are breaking the law that we take those laws seriously. In closing, I just ask that you please support House Bill 4172 to reduce illegal tobacco sales to minors, which will reduce youth tobacco use in Oregon. When fewer young people start smoking in our state, that means we're going to have a healthier workforce, less hospital visits, and overall future cost savings for the state of Oregon. So with that, I'll close, and thank you for the opportunity, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Colleen.
Thank you.
Leah?
Good afternoon, co-chair, co-tech, and members of the committee. My name is Leah Kraft, and I'm the Governmental Affairs Manager with the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. And I just wanted to provide some information to the committee very briefly, mostly hitting on some of the questions that Representative Freeman had previously about the language in the bill that reads to enforce the laws of this state concerning tobacco products. Our understanding is that there are FDA funds available to continue the underage tobacco enforcement, but that the FDA looks at two things. They look at the sales to minors and also advertising and labeling of the products within a retail establishment. And so the language about the tobacco products is just to make sure that they have the authority to look at other issues that may occur in a retail environment related to promotion of tobacco sales to minors, but that it may not necessarily be directly to expand that beyond the tobacco sales to minors.
Thank you, Leah. Thank you for your testimony. Questions for folks here? And Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you for that clarification. That is the point I'm driving at, that everybody gets up and talks about this is to make sure that retailers aren't selling tobacco to youth, but the bill allows a broader scope than what we're saying. The bill allows a broader scope than what the testimony's been. I want to make sure everybody gets that. And if we are trying to do this for what's being described, I'm great. If we're trying to do it for the broader scope, I'm fine, but we should talk about what the broader scope is. I'm always frustrated when we pass a law thinking it's going to do one thing, and then lo and behold, after we're out of here, it does an entirely different thing. So it's just sort of one of those little pet peeves of mine about a little bit of integrity in what we're doing. Yeah. So thank you for bringing that up.
Co-chairs and Representative Freeman, if I may just point out one other additional thing along those lines, is that if we do receive FDA funding to continue this enforcement, that it is our understanding that we would come before the Ways and Means Committee for that approval, and probably the limitation as well as with the plan that we would be submitting to the FDA.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Gary?
Thank you. Can you just help me understand the background a bit more? There, we have testimony here that says that until 2009, OHA did contract with OSP to do this. I guess that stopped. Why did it stop? Why do we need new enabling legislation to do something that was previously done?
Madam Chair, we do have somebody here that could kind of explain that question.
Thank you.
Representative Garris asked.
Absolutely, Mr. Co-Chair. Just identify yourself for the record.
For the record, Brian DeLeishman. I represent the OSPOA, which is the state troopers. It's my understanding that up till that time, obviously, there was some resources to have that done. In the meantime, obviously, we laid off 100 troopers in the early 2000s, and we've made continuous cuts. So with no funding, that program then got eliminated from the priorities that OSP was doing.
Follow-up. So they could do it today. It's a matter of funding. So this bill is essentially creating a separate funding mechanism.
Co-chairs, Representative Garrett, that's my understanding of what the bill actually accomplishes. Obviously, the other piece of it is using retired troopers rather than full-duty troopers.
Follow-up, Representative?
No, thanks.
Can I ask a question?
Representative Freeman.
Great. Thank you. I'm glad somebody that could have a little bit of history on this is up here now. So when the troopers previously did this work, and they weren't retired troopers, my guess is their scope of enforcement included all laws, not just tobacco laws when they were in a store.
Co-chairs, Representative Freeman, I don't have specific knowledge to what the ones that were assigned to do this program at that time would do, but in answer to your question, a trooper has full scope and authority to do anything that they see as an unlawful practice in the state of Oregon.
So as, can I follow up on that? So as we're moving forward and we're looking at using retired troopers coming back in for a specific person or for a specific purpose, that purpose needs to be pretty well defined so they know what it is they're supposed to be doing. And do you feel, I mean, have you read this, do you feel like it's clear enough to know what all they're supposed to be doing?
Co-chairs, Representative Freeman, to use some testimony that was given on the previous dog bill, my good friend Sean Cleaves, we're strongly neutral on this bill. But I've read the bill. I've had discussions with Representative Olson and with my client, the State Troopers Association, and we are neutral in the bill. We're fine with the way the bill is drafted.
Let me try one more time.
You want more from me than that?
I just want to know if you guys have some idea what the scope of your responsibility is going to be. I mean, do you think you're just going in to enforce underage selling of tobacco to underage people, or do you think it's a broader scope than that?
Co-chairs, Representative Freeman, I believe the scope is narrow enough that they're enforcing just the tobacco laws. But keep in mind, I represent the troopers. I don't represent OSP.
And again, one more quick follow-up. The tobacco laws are much broader than selling of tobacco to underage people. That's the thing I'm trying to drive at here. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, if I could point out, a lot of the rest of the tobacco laws are regarding tax enforcement, and I would really welcome help in that area.
We better define what we're doing, is all I'm saying.
Well, tobacco laws are, I'm comfortable.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions for the panel, including Mr. DeLashman? Chair Wilson?
Well, I don't have a question, but I do want to bring up, there is a dash one amendments, and we're getting a copy of that made for you right now, so you get a chance to see it. It does clarify some of the concern, I think, Representative Freeman, that you're addressing, but I don't know if, have you seen you haven't seen the dash ones either. You've just heard some of the concept of it. So, you know, if maybe we can kind of revisit this until we all get that back and see, because that would be a good thing to have discussion about.
Yes, that would. Thank you. Co-Chair Olson. We do have a dash one that could potentially deal with this issue. We're getting copies made, and so we will come back to that. Thank you for being here. I have two more folks who wanted to testify, Derek Fuller and Richard Kosison.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. The original iteration of this bill in House Judiciary had tobacco statutes enforced by liquor control agents, and we had grave concerns about expanding the law enforcement authority of liquor control agents to laws that had nothing to do with liquor. And so this most recent iteration that would place the responsibility for enforcing these laws with the Oregon State Police, where it properly resides, is something that we're certainly more willing to support. Obviously, haven't seen the dash one amendments. I can't imagine we would oppose narrowing the focus even more in that we're concerned about having broad law enforcement authority expanded to people that don't have the proper training to do that. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Kosison.
Madam Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, Richard Kosison representing the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, which is predominantly representing small, independently owned convenience stores throughout the state. While we support the general concept behind 4172 and the general concept, I believe, with few exceptions, as originally contained in House Bill 4149, we would encourage the committee strongly to narrow the focus of 4172. If one were to look at subsection 3, the department shall establish and administer a program employing retired police officers who are active reserve officers to enforce the laws of this state concerning tobacco products. For your information and reference, I passed out a outline of tobacco-related statutes in the state, and it's fairly comprehensive. And I think what we're trying to get to here is specific compliance with the federal requirements under the what is known as the Sign-R Amendment, originally enacted by the federal government in 1992, the requirements of that federal law with respect to a state, basically three requirements. And the first is a state must have on the books a law prohibiting the sale and distribution of tobacco products to minors under 18. And the state must make efforts to enforce such laws. And third, and most importantly, the state must conduct random unannounced inspections of retailers to ensure compliance with that law. So in terms of the federal law, I think the provisions are clear. In terms of the compliance, specifically with respect to the random inspections, we would support that. It is a mechanism to keep tobacco from minors, those under 18 years of age. But again, we would encourage a clarification in the existing language of House Bill 4172, and be happy to answer any questions if I might be able to do so.
Questions? Representative Garrett?
What clarification are you suggesting? Do you have language?
Co-chairs and Representative Garrett, I could develop language in short order. I would reference the federal law, because I think, again, if one were to look at the proposed language under subsection 3 of section 2, the department shall establish and enforce laws of the state concerning tobacco products. And I think you're eventually you get to a conflict. Are they enforcing some other advertising law in terms of adults? Or are they focusing on minors, which I believe they should be?
So let me just follow-up questions. I take it the gist of this, the intent, is to get at sales to minors.
Correct.
So do I hear you saying that if we come up with appropriate narrowing language to make it clear that this program is for that purpose, you'd be at least not opposed, if not supportive of the bill?
Co-chairs and Representative Garrett, no, we would support the bill, but I would encourage the committee to get back to the requirements of the federal law, and those were three-pronged requirements, and I think they were pretty specific, but they were pretty short and to the point. And that's, to me, where we should focus the bill.
Okay.
Representative Holby.
Thanks. Just real quick, I'm just curious what your objection to having retired state police enforce tobacco laws in general.
Oh.
I mean, whether or not it's minors in possession or smoking next to the front door or whatever else. I mean, these are laws that are supposed to be followed, and we have a fund to put retired state police out there to enforce the tobacco laws. Do you have a problem with somebody enforcing those laws?
Co-chairs and Representative Holby, not at all. We have been supportive of the program, and we have followed the program since the inception, early years of 1990, and I believe the state program was about 95, 96, and we have no problem with retired officers trying to enhance and enforce the requirements of the SINAR amendment. No, I think that's a very positive step.
It's good you said you like retired officers. That was a good one. President Freeman?
Thanks, Co-Chair. And I know we're not voting, and so I don't have to declare a conflict, but I am a small store owner. I deal with a lot of these issues that are on this piece of paper. Mm-hmm. So currently what will happen is when they're doing the tax thing for Representative Berger, when they come in to check that, they show up, they got their little ID on there, not the police, but the other folks that do that.
You are.
And you pull out all your receipts. You stop whatever else you're doing that day and work. All your customers in the shop that are waiting for you, everybody just stops. Unannounced, they show up. You got to dig out all your stuff. You go through all your books. You lay them all out. And you spend your hour and a half with these people to go through to check, to make sure all your little stamps are right and where you bought your product. And it is extremely time-consuming. It is a cost of doing business. Now we're saying, just for fun, let's let these state troopers do all this stuff too. So not only will you have the program that's doing it currently, you'll have another group come in at their discretion and say, stop what you're doing in your job, stop how you're making a living, get all your books out, and let me go through all this stuff again. That's the question here. I mean, if we're talking about minors, and that's what the testimony of the people that brought the bill were, let's focus this on that issue. If it's a broader issue, let's bring in and figure out how much time we're already doing and how much money we're spending enforcing other parts of the laws and make sure we're not duplicating things. That's all. It's an honest concern.
And Representative Freeman, I think you've made your point. I would just note that I don't think we're talking about this just for fun, but I get what you're saying in terms of the cost of business for the totality of tobacco-related regulations. Representative.
Yes, I appreciate that clarification of where you're going forth on this, because my concern has been that if we narrow this down so much, they could be in a store, see a violation, and not have the authority to do anything about it if we get this. I totally get what you mean about having dual systems of tobacco tax enforcement, and I think we can get there.
I'm sure.
Co-chairs, one of my primary interests is just the notion of envisioning a Representative Olson going into a 7-Eleven and trying to convince them that he's under 18 as he tries to enforce the laws.
He could do it. He's okay. I hope you're saying he could, because he's very youthful.
I think so.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Excellent, Mr. Kosasan. I wanted clarification on one point. You said that, I think what I heard you say is that a bill to achieve compliance with the SINAR amendment is not objectionable to you. Did you mean to preclude the other FDA regulations that we would need to comply with to get grant money, or Did you mean to say just the Sinar Amendment, or are you comfortable with a bill allowing retired police officers to ensure our compliance with the FDA regulations writ large?
Co-chairs and Representative Garrett, both, yes. How's that? I mean, the evolution of this bill came out of concern with non-compliance with the Sinar Amendment and a potential jeopardy of some federal dollars. That should be the first goal of this bill, I believe, to make sure that the state is definitely in compliance with federal requirements, and if those extend over to other areas, jeopardizing state standing, I don't think any responsible retailer would have a problem with that.
Okay.
But I think the focus, again, should be on the federal requirements as they relate to the Sinar Amendment.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions for the individuals ahead of us? No? Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, I'd like to actually, if Leah's able to come up and respond just a little bit, or if she wants to wait till Monday, that's fine.
Briefly, because we do want to get through a couple of things, but so for the audience, the members up here on the dais have a dash one amendment in front of them that talks about restricting, particularly line 23, where it refers to tobacco products. So, Ms. Kraft, would you introduce yourself again for the record?
Sure. For the record, Leah Kraft, Governmental Affairs Manager with the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. I just got a copy of the dash one amendment. And I think part of the larger question, I think, for us in looking at this amendment is that if we as a state want to go forward and look for FDA grants that would continue this as an ongoing program, that narrowing it this specifically would put us in a position where we probably would not qualify for those FDA monies, because it puts us pretty much, as was mentioned earlier, back in the enforcement ability or capabilities that we currently have. And so there is not an ongoing revenue source dedicated to this type of enforcement. So my first look at this would be that it may prohibit those abilities for continual FDA funding.
And Ms. Kraft, if I could just clarify, so since not everyone has it in front of them, by limiting it to the age restriction that we have in the dash one, that could preclude us from having additional resources or having even these resources available. Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Representative,
I know you're in, but that's my very point. So the bill really, the testimony was about the underage, but the bill is about a much broader desire for the health authority. That's what I'm trying to get at.
I think it's about a desire to make sure we have the resources to enforce minors, and then if we write this in a way, what I'm hearing is if we write it in such a way that would preclude us from getting the federal dollars we hope to get to enforce minors by writing it too limited. I understand your concern. I think we have to figure out how we do this to get the goal of the resources and getting the folks out in the field, and but not making your life miserable on a regular basis.
I've never had a problem. I'm just pointing out that it
no, you're just pointing out it's cost of doing business, but it is. It needs to be clear, and I get that. Thank you for your questions, Representative. Other comments on questions on this topic? Thank you. We appreciate you being here. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 4172 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4171. Cheyenne, if you could let us know what this is about.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 4171. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no subsequent referral. It modifies the deadline for the Secretary of State to file information with county clerks regarding candidates for office of President and Vice President of the United States at the November 2012 general election. Declares an emergency, is effective on passage.
Thank you, Cheyenne. Colleagues, an elections bill, and we have Steve Trout, State Election Director, and Greg Leo here to testify. Please come on down and join us.
I used to think elections issues were interesting to anyone on this committee.
would like to go first? Mr. Trout, would you?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Election Director. And just like last year, as soon as my bills get up, there's nobody in the audience. But thanks for
we need to change that
for a relatively quick and easy bill. The need for this bill arises because of the lateness of the national conventions for president and the current timelines. The nominee for one of the parties would not have been formally selected, and so we just needed to add this extension in as we did 4 years ago. And so that's really all this is about. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Trout. And it is 11 lines long, which we appreciate the brevity. Mr. Leo.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kotek and Co-Chair Olson, members of the House Rules Committee. Greg Leo here today in my capacity as Chief of Staff of the Oregon Republican Party. This is a very important housekeeping measure to get our presidential candidates from both major parties on the general election ballot. And I was counting the days, we think, although nothing is really certain about the Republican primary this year. But we do think that on the evening of Thursday, August 30th, the Republican Party will be nominating its president and vice president. That, by my count, is 67 days. So we think the problem is a little bit worse for the Democratic Party as they meet in Charlotte, but we believe that would be, by my count at least, on the 61st day. So this bill really does benefit, I think, both parties in terms of making the deadline to get our president and vice presidential nominees on the Oregon general election ballot. We urge a due pass on this, and we think it's an important housekeeping measure.
Thank you, Mr. Leo. Questions for our testifiers? Seeing none. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to close the work session or the public hearing on 4171 and work session on 4171.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, I move House Bill 4171 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Olson has moved House Bill 4171 to the House floor with the due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. Need a carrier. Okay. Representative Escobar will carry. Thank you so much. Close public hearing on 4171. And open a work session on SCR 204. Is anyone here for 204, 203, or 201? Nope. Okay. Well, then actually close that work session. Let's start off now in numerical order. Open a work session on SCR 201.
Chairs, members of the committee, SCR 201 has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no subsequent referral. It honors Officer Chris Kilcullen of the Eugene Police Department. Most of all of you are familiar with the story. He's a Eugene native, graduated from Willamette High School, went to University of Oregon, joined the Eugene Police Department in 1998, had a 12-year career during which he earned more than 85 commendations, was twice named the department's employee of the month, was crucial to creating the department's crisis intervention team, and served on the department's crisis negotiation team. He was killed in the line of duty April 22nd of 2011. He survived by his wife, Christy, his daughter, Katie Ann, and his stepdaughter, Sydney. And last year, part of State Highway 126 was renamed the Officer Kilcullen Memorial Highway in his memory, running from the intersection of Highway 26 and 7th Avenue in Eugene to its intersection with Main Street in Springfield. This resolution recognizes his service to the people of the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Cheyenne. We don't have anyone here to testify, but we do appreciate the resolution recognizing the life and work of Officer Kilcullen. And any discussion, colleagues, on this resolution? Seeing none.
You want a motion?
But Representative Holby.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, just say something real quick. You know, I attended one of the services after this happened, and you know, it was just a devastating blow to the community. And really appreciate the co-chairs bringing this forward. Really, it means a lot to our community down there, and to their family as well.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate that.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Byer.
Just quickly, while he was not a constituent of mine, he was what most people would consider a constituent of the area that worked in Eugene, lived right outside of Springfield. He was well-loved and greatly missed in the community. and the incident did happen in my district.
Thank you, Representative. Co-Chair Olson?
Yep. And Madam Co-Chair, I move, it's a Senate Concurrent Resolution 201 to the floor to be adopted recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Olson moves Senate Concurrent Resolution 201 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Further discussion, colleagues? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Just also for the record that Representative Barnhart on these votes is excused. Thank you.
I think Representative Hoyle will be the one that, you know, is interested in carrying that.
Representative Hoyle? This is Representative Barnhart. I assume the Lane County folks is okay. If for
we'll
some reason there's a change on that, let us know.
Yeah.
But Representative Hoyle will be the carrier on that. I suspect we'll hear.
Hoyle, two out of three balls.
With that, we'll close the work session on SCR 201 and open a work session on SCR 203. Chairs, members of the committee, SCR 203 is no revenue, no fiscal, no subsequent referral, and it commemorates the Jubilee Year of the Sisters of St. Mary of Oregon, and there is some material that was distributed in your packets at the dais and on the shared drive. Sisters of St. Mary of Oregon was founded in Sublimity in 1886 and has provided 125 years of uninterrupted, dedicated ministry and service. Their mission includes serving the needy, founding educational ministries, and caring for the elderly and disabled. They are, and I've quoted some of the actual language of the resolution, selfless women of prayer, living in simplicity and sisterly love, who have been turning faith into action for countless others and without fanfare for well more than a century. Their 125th year comes to a close on March 25th, 2012. This resolution celebrates.
Thank you, Cheyenne. And I don't believe we have anyone here to testify on 203. It did have a full hearing on the Senate side. Any discussion, colleagues, on this resolution? Seeing none, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah. Madam Co-Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 203 to the floor to be adopted recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chair Olson moves SCR 203 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And I believe Representative Barker will be carrying SCR 203 on the floor. And with that, we'll close the work session on SCR 203 and open a work session on SCR 204.
Chairs and members of the committee, SCR 204, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no subsequent referral. This resolution commemorates the centennial of women's suffrage in Oregon and the efforts of those who led women's suffrage campaign of 1912. You have the background information that was previously prepared in the other chamber. Before you, I won't read the whole thing, but the first paragraph. This year, 2012, marks 100 since Oregon became one of the first states where women could vote. The history of women's suffrage in Oregon is one of perseverance that is uniquely Oregonian, because I understand it, the first two efforts to put the vote to voters were brought by the Legislative Assembly, but the final three efforts to bring the vote were by citizen initiative when it was new. The right was obtained in 1912 after those five failed statewide ballot measures and 8 years before the ratification of the 19th Amendment of the United States Constitution.
Thank you, Cheyenne. It was a good year for women with the centennial of suffrage. Discussion on this measure. We see thumbs up in the audience. Thank you so much. Other discussion on this resolution? Seeing none, Co-Chair Olson?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 204 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chair Olson moves Senate Concurrent Resolution 204 to the House floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objection? Be careful on this. Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Berger, would you like to carry?
I would be honored.
Representative Berger will be our carrier. That closes the work session on SCR 204. I'd like to open a I'd like to open a work session on possible on introduction of committee measures. Colleagues, you have you should have in front of you, and we always appreciate your indulgence as we move legislative concepts in front of you quickly. You should have 309, 313, 314, and 316. 314 just came in here while we were sitting here.
Did you miss that?
309 is related to security procedures around ballots. And 313, 314, and 316 are some legislative concepts being requested by the County Payment Task Force. And so we don't know where these will end up, but that's why you have a trio there. Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills as a block. LC 309, dated February 13th, 2012. LC 313, dated February 14th, 2012. LC 314, dated February 14th, 2012. And LC 316, dated February 15th, 2012.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Co-Chair Olson moves that LCs 309, dated the 13th of February, and 313, dated the 14th of February, 314, dated the February 14th, and 316, dated February 15th, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Not seeing any.
Go right ahead.
Just wanted to do the vice chair's duties of informing everybody that voting to introduce the concept is not indicative of a member's position, if any, on the merits of the concept.
You know, I don't agree with that.
What?
I'm just kidding.
Thank you, co-vice chair Hovey. Further discussion?
Good job,
dude. Seeing none, any objections to the introduction committee measures? Seeing none. So ordered. With that, we will close the work session on introduction committee measures. And colleagues, I believe the next time we're here is Monday.
Monday. 1 o'clock.
We're getting a lot more popular, so we'll have lots of work to do on Monday. With that, we are adjourned.